And we all know the 9th of November is a very special date. It's called Kristallnacht, the night of the broken glasses. When the rabbi made his introduction, he told over a story which happened to him when he was in a Jewish delegation to visit with the then Prime Minister Harpert from Canada, Benjamin Netanyahu, in Israel. In this Jewish delegation, there was a rabbi, other important Jewish figures from the community, and an old Holocaust survivor. And this Holocaust survivor, he swore to himself never ever after the war to go back to Germany. He hated Germany, didn't buy nothing made in Germany. What he didn't know was that they didn't flew with a normal airplane from Toronto to Tel Aviv, Ben Gurion. They went with a military plane. And the military plane cannot do the whole flight in one go. They had to make a stopover. And the stopover was in Cologne. So after a couple of hours, the plane goes down. The Holocaust survivor looks from the window and says, "Wow, Israel became very green." So they told him, "No, it's not Israel, it's Cologne." So he went, "Cologne? Köln? This is Germany." "Yeah, it's Germany. We have a stopover here for the next 3 hours, and then we go from here to Tel Aviv." "I don't leave the plane," he said. He said, "Okay, I understand, Holocaust survivor, you don't want to leave the plane, but you know, now you're here already, everybody has to leave the plane. You know Jewish mentality." Sitting back like this, the stewardess tried, then the security came and tried, and he became loud. President Harpert was on his way out of the airplane, and he heard something's going on in the back. So he went, and they told him he's a Holocaust survivor, and he swore to himself never to put his feet on German soil. Harpert said, "We leave him in the plane alone for 3 hours. It's on my shoulders, it's on me." And it was the first time in the history of the security of the president of Canada that something like this was allowed, to leave somebody in the plane alone. We Jews in Germany, and we Jews in general, we know people like this. People who hate Germany, people who don't want to have nothing to do with Germany. One of the lectures, somebody told me, they had one person in shul, he really hated Germany. Everything made in Germany, if somebody came and bought something made in Germany, he started to scream at him and start machloket. And one day he came with a BMW. So the people asked him, you know, "A BMW? How it's possible you come with a BMW? He said, "What's the problem with a BMW? He said, "You know what BMW stands for?" He said, "Yeah, British Motor Works." It's Bavarian Motor Works. I want to tell you a second story which happened. Also, same thing, Holocaust survivor, hates Germany. But it happened that his grand-grandchildren today are living in Germany. And it happened that his grand-grandchildren, through the work of Chabad in Germany, became religious in Germany. And one day, this Holocaust survivor got an invitation to a wedding in Germany. And he didn't know, should I go, shouldn't I go? I never wanted to go back to Germany, but to miss the wedding of my grand-grandchildren, in the end he came. During the whole chuppah, and later the festivities afterwards, you could see in his face that he's in a different world. And during the dinner, he asked for the microphone. And when he was standing before the hall, everybody became silent, because everybody understood, now something very interesting is going to happen. And he opened his sleeve, and he showed everybody the number. And he said, "I am a survivor from the camps. And after the war, I was full of hate against this country, against Germany and against the Germans. But this hate was eating me up. I didn't know what to do with this hate. What should I do? Should I take a gun and kill some Germans and feel better?" But then he said, "But today, when I see my grand-grandchildren under the chuppah with talit, kippah, with a hat," and then he said, "this is my revenge." He said Hitler didn't want any Jew to be alive, especially in Germany. He wanted Germany to be Judenrein, free of Jews. "We don't give it to him," that's what he said. "My grand-grandchildren are walking on the streets of Germany with a hat and with a kippah, and every German should see the Jewish people are alive and proud. This is the worst thing which can happen to Hitler rotating in hell from my grandchildren in Germany. So we see there are two ways to view the whole topic of Jews being today in Germany. What I want to do tonight is to take you on a tour through the history of my Jewish community, the Jewish community of Krefeld. Krefeld, I know it's for Americans sometimes hard to pronounce, you can call it Kreplach if you want, is a city which is close to Düsseldorf and close to Cologne. On the left side, there is the border, the next country are the Netherlands, Holland, and the next country would be Belgium. Belgium, for us, very important because they say the last shtetl of Europe today is the Jewish community in Antwerp, which is in Belgium. It's an hour and a half from our city, and everything Jewish, what we need, all our kosher food, everything we get from Antwerp. Krefeld has about 250,000 people living in the city. I want to start with the oldest item we have in our community. And here you see a very old Kiseh Shel Eliyahu, the chair of the prophet Elijah. As you know, when a Jewish boy is born, on the eighth day after he's born, he gets his circumcision. And the circumcision is done on a special bench called the Kiseh Shel Eliyahu. Our Kiseh Shel Eliyahu is from the year 1765. 1765, and I call it a real wonder. Why do I call it a real wonder? Because first of all, who of us, from us, has furniture at home from 1765? 1765, and you can still sit on it, it's also a big wonder. 1765, open a Jewish history book. What happened in Jewish history since 1765, especially in Germany? Two world wars. How did this bench survive the Shoah? When the Jewish community in Krefeld saw that any day something terrible could happen to the Jewish community, they took the most precious items, Sefer Torah and the chair of the prophet Elijah, and they gave it to their good Christian neighbors. And they took in all those items and they hid it. And after the war, it took many, many years until there was again a Jewish community to give it back. Also a big wonder. But there's a bigger wonder. Not that we have furniture from 1765, we can still sit on it, and it's still there. The biggest wonder is that we are still there. And here you see a picture of the first circumcision which was done in our community, in the new community center, by the Moel Weiss, who came from Antwerp, on the same bench where the Jews in Krefeld did circumcision 1765 on it. We say, when you build a house, the most important is a good foundation. If you can build the nicest and beautiful house, if you don't have a good foundation, one day the whole thing can collapse. The same is true in the spiritual worlds. If you have a good foundation of Torah and mitzvot, whatever will happen, chas v'shalom, to this ground, the foundation will always stand, and you can always build something strong back on this foundation. And when you know your Jewish history, you know that in Germany, many, many holy rabbis lived in Germany. Just to mention Rashi, who was living in Worms, near to Frankfurt. We Jews in Krefeld, Baruch Hashem, are matzliach in Yiddishkeit, and we believe it's because of the first rabbi in the city who made the foundation, which was Rabbi Yehuda Leib Kalbuch. He was the rabbi and the Av Beit Din, this means he was the head of the Jewish court in Krefeld, until 1835. He was a very, very famous rabbi, so famous that even Napoleon Bonaparte wanted Rabbi Kalbuch to serve in his Sanhedrin. Napoleon had such an idea that the Jews in Europe should govern themselves, same as in the times of the Temple of the Beit HaMikdash. And Napoleon chose 71 rabbis to be in a panel of rabbis to deal with Jewish questions, and Rabbi Kalbuch was one of those rabbis. But Rabbi Kalbuch didn't like that much the choices Napoleon did, and he didn't want to go. So Napoleon was a character as Putin perhaps is today, such a character, and you cannot just tell him, I don't want to go. So he did something what we sometimes do still today. He went to a doctor to get a letter that he cannot serve in the Beis Din because he has a serious problem with one of his eyes. Later, when they made paintings of the rabbi, they always made sure to tell the artist, when you paint the eyes, one of the eyes has to be a little bit like this, just in the case Napoleon will take a look. When I became the rabbi of Krefeld in the year 2007, I found a book. And this book was written by a non-Jewish professor for Jewish studies in Germany. And he wrote a book about the old Jewish cemetery in our city. Our cemetery, as many cemeteries in Germany, were not destroyed by the Nazis in the Holocaust. But what the Nazis did, in the end of the war, they came and they stole everything metal from the cemetery. Why? Because everything which was metal went into bullet production in the end of the war. So after the war, when there was again a Jewish community, they found, Baruch Hashem, the cemetery is still there, but there are hundreds of stones where you have no idea who's buried there because all the metal was gone. And the professor for more than a year worked on this cemetery every day, and with a special technique, with a camera and shadows and however he did it, he published the book and he found out the text from the stones. And in this book I saw, wow, the grave of the famous Rabbi Kahlburg is still there in Krefeld. And here you have a picture of my daughter by the grave of Rabbi Kahlburg. And you see it's a naked stone, and also the other stones, all the stones are naked because the Nazis, they stole all the metals from there. When Rabbi Kahlburg passed away, the community got a new rabbi. And his name was Rabbi Dr. Leon Ullmann. And he had something in his name most Jews in this time didn't understood. Dr., doctor. You can be a rabbi, you can be a doctor, or you can be both. We are speaking about times where Jews were finally allowed, times of Napoleon, to visit, to study in the university. So Rabbi Ullmann was such a rabbi who was a little bit more modern than the rabbi before Rabbi Kahlburg. Rabbi Ullmann became world famous, and he is so world famous that I'm pretty sure nobody of you ever heard about him. But he's also, most of the Jews in Krefeld don't know about him, but many, many Muslims in Germany, they know about him. So it's possible that the Muslims know about him, but we Jews don't know about him, because he was the first person ever to translate the Quran from the Arabic language into the German language. So many people in the room might think, why does the Jewish community need to pay a rabbi to translate the Quran into the German language? Same thing happened, I guess, also in those times in Krefeld, and it started to be the first split in our community. The next rabbi was Rabbi Bodenheimer. Rabbi Horowitz was the next rabbi. And the last rabbi, until 1938, Dr. Arthur Blum in Krefeld. This is the Jewish community, how it looked. Every week, I have about three times, I take non-Jewish school children through the Jewish community to explain them, to tell them about the Holocaust, and to tell them about Judaism. And when I have a school class, the first thing I always show them is this picture, and I ask the children, what do you see on this picture? So what they answer? A church. Everybody answers a church. So why did the Jewish community in Krefeld in those times look like a church? And the answer is because the Jews of Krefeld, as in many, many cities in Germany, perhaps in Europe, they thought we Jews have a serious problem, and this problem is called anti-Semitism. People hate us. If we open a Jewish history book, every page, hate, kicked out from this country, killed over there, pogroms, always problems. It can't be that it's always the fault of the other people. It must be our fault. If you have a child in a school, and everybody in the school is mobbing your child, doesn't like your child, you take it into a second class. If the same thing happens in the second class, you take it to a different school. And if in the second school the same problems are starting, you can't say it's the problem of the other children, it's the problem of your child. So why does everybody hate us? The Jews in Krefeld understood, because we are different from everybody else. If we are going to be like everybody else, hate will stop. For sure. So let's be like everybody else. Our Jewish community should have the same architect who's building the church on the other street side. Our community service should not be in Hebrew, because when I bring my non-Jewish German friend to a service, I want him to understand what's going on. But if we are honest and we know our prayer book, we perhaps don't want them to understand everything which it says over there. So we have to kick everything out from the prayer book which doesn't fit into the picture. Something like praying that Moshiach will come and take us to Jerusalem. I don't want my German neighbor to ask me, you are praying somebody will come and take you out from Germany to Jerusalem? No, God forbid. My Jerusalem is Hamburg. My Jerusalem is Berlin. I don't want to go to Jerusalem somewhere, wherever. So, and so it started and it started and it started. And then one day, the member board came together. And in Germany, a board, the member board, is something very, until today, something very, very powerful. I always say it works like this. You have the rabbi here, you have God here, and you have the board on top. So one day the board came together and they had a discussion why we don't have so many people coming to shul, which is a good question. And the discussion was something like, the problem is because Friday night is just not a good day for Shabbat. So if we would put the Shabbat from Friday to Sunday, because Sunday nobody needs to work, everybody goes to church, you know, we do it like this on Sunday, many more people will come to our community. And that far it went in our city. So at this time, you still had a group of about 60 to 80 Jews still following the ways of the first rabbi, Rabbi Kahlburg, you saw, and they called themselves the Machane Yehuda, the camp of Yehuda. They were also davening, praying in this big building, but not in the main shul. They had something called a shtibel, a small place in the cellar where they were praying every Shabbat. So one day, the member board came together and they said, "Dear Machane Yehuda, it just doesn't look good if you come to our community with your beards, with your hats, and you come on the wrong day, you come on Shabbat, you come on Friday night and you don't come on Sunday. It would be very nice if you could find a different place where you can meet." In this Machane Yehuda was a person with the name Rosen. And he said, if the board kicks us out, no problem. I own a house in Krefeld and we make a little renovation and the first floor will be dedicated as a community. Here you see Westwall number 20, which became the Orthodox Stiebel from the Machane Yehuda. And this is a picture which I took a couple of years ago. This building is still standing in Krefeld. The last service the Machane Yehuda had in this building was Purim 1938. After they read the Megillah, they closed the doors, and the Rosen family, they immigrated, they ran away, first to the Netherlands, and then to Swiss, and survived the war. As I told you, I became the rabbi in 2007, and we have this book about the old Jewish cemetery. So since 2007, I'm meeting every year people from all over the world coming to our community to look for their grandparents or great-grandparents and ask our help to locate them on the Jewish cemetery because we have the book. All the people, with very, very few exceptions I ever met, are not Jewish anymore. It's always, my grandfather was Jewish, my great-grandfather was Jewish. The first family I ever met, not just Jewish, but religious, with kippah and with the tzitzit, was the Rosen family. And he came, Mr. Rosen, the son of the Rosen who started the project, came in 2012 to visit our community. And when he came, he had this idea to go back and see this building over there. But today, a normal German family is living in this building. He said, okay, whatever, let's just go, ring the bell and see what happens. So we went with the whole minion to this house. We knocked the door. A nice German person opened, got the shock of his life. The minion is standing there already. And he said, I'm Mr. Rosen. This is the story of the building you're living. It's a very holy place. It used to be a synagogue. before the war, and it would be very nice if you could let us in. It would be a lot of memories for me. And this person, this family over there, was very, very nice. They let him in. He showed everything there. We had this, the sukkah. There we had this. The Sefer Torah was in this room. And very, very moving. On one door, you could still see two nails from the mezuzah, which they took down in 1938. So, if we will be like everybody else, if we will be like our German neighbors, hate for sure will stop. And then came Kristallnacht, the 9th November 1938, and you see the community who looked like a church, and that's the way it looked on the 10th of November 1938. What happened in Krefeld on the Kristallnacht, on the night of the broken glasses? The 9th of November was in Germany a holiday. It's called St. Martin. You don't have this holiday here in America. It's perhaps a little bit similar to Halloween, meaning children are going from door to door and they sing songs and they get candies. The city was packed with people. 6 o'clock, the Nazis are coming to the building, but they're not wearing the Nazi uniform. They're wearing normal civil clothing because they want to show everybody this hate against the Jews is not coming from the NSDAP, from the party. This is coming out of the population of the city. They broke open the doors. They put benzin, gasoline all over, and they put the shul on fire. Many people in the city. So the people see through the windows the community is burning. So they call the police and they call the fire department. The fire department came right away. They ran into the building, but they didn't bother to turn out the flames. They were looking, where's the room where the Jews store all the wine bottles which they use for Kiddush? And the young firefighters stole the wine and they were sitting on benches on the other street side saying, so to say, L'chaim, and seeing the whole thing go up in flames. The 9th of November, 38, for the Nazis was a test trial. A test trial to see what's going to happen in the world when in two days, we're going to destroy over 1,000 synagogues all over Germany. What's Soviet Russia going to do? What the French are going to do? The English? What are the United States are going to do? When I spoke in the Holocaust Museum in Detroit, over there they had a huge section in the museum on the 9th of November, and very, very impressive photocopies, huge boards like this, of the photocopies of the Washington Post, the New York Times, how much space they gave on the 10th, 11th of November to what happened in Germany. Page 22, such a little article. No protests on the street, no pressure on the German government. So if we can take all the rights away from the Jews, when we can burn the books of the Jews, when we can burn the synagogues of the Jews and nobody stands up, then we can also burn the Jews and nobody will stand up. And unfortunately, we see from history, this is just what happened. Nobody came to stop the Holocaust. To stop the Holocaust was part of the whole war against Nazi Germany, but especially to come and to say, everybody knew, people run away, people told what's going on in Auschwitz. One plane, one bomb on the railroads going to the concentration camps, but nobody did nothing, and the 9th of November was the first start. Krefeld did not have just one synagogue. Every suburb of the community had a little shul or a bigger shul. And here's another suburb of Krefeld called Krefeld-Leningast, destroyed on the 10th of November 1938. Nothing is left from this building besides, you see on the right picture, two stones. The two stones you see, they are those, how to call this in English? You know, you have these two like towers, right and left, yeah, pillars, two pillars, and then on top you have those two stones. Those two stones survived the war. Why they survived? Because later people took those stones and they marked the entrance to a parking lot of a shop in the city for many, many, many years, until more or less recently, about 12 years ago, A non-Jewish historian called up our community to speak to the president. And she came with this picture. And she said, do you know this and this shop like a Walmart? Yes. You know those two stones to drive in? Yes. You see the picture? It's those two stones. When he, the president of the community, heard about it, the same day he called the company to go to this parking lot to take those two stones back to the Jewish community. So this is Germany, everything is law and order today, and it's not like Russia, you cannot just go to a parking lot and start taking it apart. So German police came right away, what are you doing over here? The president took out this picture and he went to the policeman and he showed him, those two stones are our stones and we take them home. The policeman said, you're 1,000% right. He went into his car. And he drove away. No report, nothing. And today they're on display in our museum. When the synagogue in a city next to Krefeld was burning on the 9th of November, and people were standing around the synagogue, like the firefighters and the police, cheering. But to be honest, there have been many people who were angry, and there have been people crying. But those people who finally woke up, 1938, woke up much, much too late. In the city called Viersen-Dülken, next to Krefeld, the priest was living on the other street side of the shul. At night, he hears there's something going on. He looks from his window and he sees the synagogue is burning. And he, the priest, he ran into the building and he saved the Sefer Torah from the flames. And here you have a picture of this Sefer Torah. For somebody to do something like this in 1938 was very, very dangerous. Because doing something like this, next morning you wake up in the concentration camp in Dachau near Munich, but he still did it. And after the war, when there was again a community, he gave it back to us. Simchat Torah, it's not that long ago, we danced through the community with the Torah scrolls. And the halacha says you can also dance with the Torah scroll, which is not kosher anymore. And if you take a closer look, this Torah, unfortunately, is not kosher anymore because the priest had to bury it. He put it into plastic foils and bags, but still moisture came to it. And it's not kosher because if one letter is missing, the whole Torah is not kosher anymore. This doesn't mean we cannot dance with it. And by us, it's the minhag that the first Torah we take out is the Holocaust Torah, and it's leading the other Torah scrolls in dancing. Even though it's not kosher anymore, it's still very, very holy because somebody put his life on the line or risked his life in order to save it. In Krefeld and most places, I guess, in Germany, Holocaust education is something very, very special. And it's very important in the German school system. How early Holocaust education, at least in our town, starts, I found out when I got my first kindergarten group, this is a German word by the way, coming to visit our community. And normally when all the children are coming, adults are coming, I tell them the story of the 9th of November I just told you. But now I have innocent children, 3 years old, 4 years old, what I'm going to tell them about the 9th of November? I'm going to tell them what's the mezuzah, what's the Sefer Torah. After 20 minutes, a child went like this and he said, Rabbi, when you tell us the story of the bad people who burned your synagogue. So I went to the kindergarten teacher and I asked her, you spoke to the children already about the Holocaust? She said, yes. We do it in a very childish, more or less way, but we want to understand the children, even when they're very, very young in kindergarten, that something terrible, terrible happened. And that's how I found out how early Holocaust education can really start. There was a teacher, and she dedicated all her life, a non-Jewish teacher, to teaching Holocaust to her students. And when she before she passed away, she made the last will. And in the last will, she said she wants to donate everything she ever made with her students to the Jewish community. The rabbi should come after she passes away, should come to her house, see what she did, and I can take whatever I want. One of the things I took was this. Here you see a door. And on this door, you see two maps. On the left side, the bigger map, is a city map of the city of Krefeld, and on the right side you see a map of Eastern Europe. What she found out with her school children, with her class, where were all the Jews in Krefeld living? And we had about 1,500 Jews living in Krefeld. About 800 of them got killed in the Holocaust. And from every address they could find, she put a nail. And then she found out what happened to this family, and she put a nail where they ended their life. And so you see, Jews were living all over the city center, all over the city center, and then they were deported to the different concentration camps. Many Jews from Krefeld were killed in Riga, in Letland, over there. Today, there is something in Germany since many years called stumbling blocks. Perhaps you heard about it. Stumbling blocks is a German non-Jewish, I would call it like an artist, who had this idea that every place where German Jewish or a Jewish family lived in Germany before the Holocaust, there should be a memorial and people should know about it. So he created this idea of stumbling blocks, to take a stone which looks like gold, and on top you see in this building over here lived family XYZ, and they got deported, later killed in wherever, or survived the war. And he has about now, let me, 1 second, I just put it in here. 50,000. By now, the number is 50,000 stones he put all over Germany, and they're called stumbling stones because they are in the place on the street where you walk. When he started his project, many Jewish communities were against his idea. Also, our president was not that much in favor, and the reason was that he was afraid that people are walking over it. And what the Nazis in some places did, where they were not so lucky, like in Krefeld, where they didn't touch that much the cemetery, and they took the Jewish tombstones and they put it into the pavement where you walk. So for him, it was something like somehow similar. Dogs are walking over it. But the problem was that if you put it into a house, you need the reshut, the permission. You need the permission of the person living over there. If you put it in the walkway, then you have to deal with the city. This is much easier. So his idea went through, and by now, the Jewish community is supporting his idea. You see, here Julius Afeld lived, and then he was deported to Theresienstadt, and then later he survived the war. And that's the way it looks. So it's called stumbling stones because you walk on the street and suddenly you see something gold. So you take a look, and then you see that in this house a Jewish family used to live before the war. If you have something like this, you can also find something like this. So, unfortunately, Baruch Hashem, in Krefeld, I never saw it, but there are places where they write lie, like a liar they put with graffiti over the stones, which is very hard for us to see something like this. So, the place where the Jewish community stood before the war, today it's the place of the old synagogue, and this is our memorial over there. You see 6 stones for the 6 million Jews who got killed in the Shoah, in different sizes, a symbol of the Jewish family. Every 9th of November, the mayor of the city of Krefeld, school classes, many, many people from the city, the Jewish community, everybody comes together for a memorial of about 1 hour, every 9th of November. Last 9th of November, it was very, very cold and it was raining. I think in English you say cats and dogs. It was like crazy weather. I came, I was on the way to this memorial thing over there to say a prayer, and I thought to myself, you know, who is going to come out by this weather, you know, to the 9th of November? And it was very, very nice to see that like 200 people with their umbrellas were already standing there and waiting, because it's something very important in the conscience of the city. It sounds very nice, but I also have to tell you that a couple of years ago, during the minute of silence, a window opened of a house next to the place, and somebody screamed, "Enough is enough! How much we have to pay what we did in the war!" So people like this, you have always stupid people, but it's still a good thing to see that the 9th of November, you cannot really miss that it's the 9th of November in Germany. So what we did in the year 2009, we brought a 5 meter high Chanukiah. And our idea was to celebrate Chanukah not just in the community center, but they should again burn a fire on this place where they burned the shul, but this time a fire of hope and a fire of victory. So we took our big Chanukiah to this place. The mayor made a big speech. Television was there. People were dancing. And this was a very moving thing which happened to see that we celebrate the Jewish victory and Jewish pride on such a place. And it was covered all over Germany in newspapers and in the television. Second. Back in history. After the war, many, many years, no Jews. 1981, again, 130 Jews live in Krefeld. And they decide we have to restart the Jewish community. On the 1st May 1981, they opened in an empty factory building. They dedicated one floor with 130 community members. Big party, 130 seats, every seat taken, wonderful. First Shabbos, from 130 people, how many show up? 30. Couple of weeks later, less and less, until a couple of years later, Yom Kippur Kol Nidre, 9 men show up. 9 men, Kol Nidre, is a death sentence for a Jewish community. After this Yom Kippur, the member board came together with a discussion. Should we keep on the Jewish community, or should we just close down and every Jew in Krefeld will become a member of the Jewish community in Düsseldorf, which is like 25 minutes drive away? Two people fighting. One person wants to close down, the other wants to keep it up. The one who wanted to close down the community, his profession was to make statistics. And he told the other person who wanted to keep the community alive, he told him, I make you a statistic for free. Very easy math. How many community members we have? Okay. How many of them are over 60 years old? How many children were born in the last year? How many children might be born in the future? Put all this together and you see, in a couple of years, Yom Kippur, we are the only two to hold the Torah, God willing. The other one gave him a very, very Jewish and very, very good answer. He told him, please, stop talking about statistics, because Jews and statistics just don't go together. And if Jews and statistics would go together, there wouldn't be a lecture today here. There wouldn't be a strong Judaism in America. There wouldn't be a state of Israel. And for sure, there wouldn't be a Jewish community in Krefeld. Forget about statistics. We are going to fight, and the Jewish community will survive. He wasn't a Navi, but then came the year 1989. In 1989, the world started to spin in a different direction. The Berlin Wall fell, and Soviet Russia collapsed. And millions of Jews who were trapped behind the Iron Curtain finally free. And many, many of those Jews seemingly left Russia right away from Russia to Brighton Beach in New York. Many went right away to Tel Aviv and to Netanya. And interestingly, many of the Russian Jews came to Germany. And suddenly, our Jewish community, which was so small and so few people came, every month new members came to our community. And in those times, they were also called refugees. A little bit later, we speak about other refugees we have today in Germany. So suddenly, the community had over 1,000 members again. So stop talking about statistics, because God doesn't always go confirm with the statistics. And then Krefeld needed a bigger synagogue. When you need a bigger synagogue, you also need a rabbi. And here you have an article, which was when I became the rabbi 2007, the first rabbi since 70 years. So at one lecture, and some, there always has to be at least one nutnik in the crowd. So one nutnik said, ah, the rabbi is still wearing the same jacket as on the picture. And it's true, by divine providence, if this is this jacket, the only difference today, I cannot close it anymore. So, 1 second. Here we have a picture from 14 September 2008, where we opened a new community center. And here you see a picture, me on the right. Next to me is the mayor of the city. Next to him is Mrs. Dr. Knobloch. She is the president of German Jewry. Next to her is the minister president of Germany. And next to him is Mr. Schwarz. And Mr. Schwarz is the son. He became the president of the community. He's the son of the person who said, stop talking about statistics. This is the shul, how it looks today. Baruch Hashem, it's a big shul, and this we have enough place. So history repeating, you see 1981, and then you have a picture of shortly before Yom Kippur, and today, Baruch Hashem, Kol Nidre, last Kol Nidre, we had about 200 people who came to the service. One of the nice items we have in our community are those windows. They were made by a famous German artist called Thornpricker. Thornpricker Fenster, Thornpricker Windows. The original windows you see on the left side, 1938, were smashed in the Reichskristallnacht, the night of the broken glasses, because so many windows were smashed. But the company who did it, 1901, is still in business today. And when they heard Krefeld is getting a new community, they came and they had said, we have a nice idea. Why shouldn't the same company who did it 1901 redo one-to-one the same windows? And that's what we did. And today you can see the same windows as you were able to see it until the 9th of November 1938. Today, Baruch Hashem, Krefeld, a vibrant community. We have a restaurant in our community. You see my daughter eating two pizzas and drinking Coke. The most important what we have, like every Jewish community all over, the weddings. And we deal mostly, as you know, see from our history, with Russian Jews. And many, many Russian Jews just find out that according to Jewish law, they are not really married. Many of them, they like the idea that they're not really married. But some of them, they really say, we want to have also be married in the eyes of God. So we have weddings, as you see here, from all the people who have already children who go under the chuppah. And last year, we had a wedding in the summer of a couple where they were over 80 years old. And it was so cute to see how the kala walked around him like this. Took her like 15 minutes. And the chatan, he needed mamish 3 times until he broke the glass. But it's very heartwarming to see. The second thing is the circumcision. Jews in Russia, the chance that you get a circumcision, very, very small. So we're very happy to see that Jews in the all the Jews come to us and they ask to have the circumcision performed. And here you see a picture of the cousin of my wife 10 minutes after the circumcision. That's why we have to hold him a little bit like this. And it was done in Antwerp. The next story is an amazing story, one of the most amazing stories which happened to me. In the middle, you see a Jew from Dnipropetrovsk in Ukraine. And he was never in his life in a Jewish community until his mother passed away and I did the funeral. After the funeral, I told to him, Leonid, you have to come at least for the next 11 months to say the Kaddish prayer for your mother. He agreed and he came every Shabbat. After a couple of months, you could see that this Jew, who was never in a shul before, he started to learn. He started to really embrace his Judaism. And one day he came and said, Rabbi, I don't like you call everybody up to the Torah with a Jewish name, and you call me Leonid Ben Boris. I want to have a Jewish name as well. So I told him, okay, great. Jewish name goes together with the circumcision. So he was like, oi. After one Shabbat, he came and said, I'm very afraid of this, but I think it's very, very important, and I want to have a circumcision to get a Jewish name. So I told him, Leonid, please don't be offended, but now we still have, I know and I believe that you are Jewish, but we still have to prove your papers, because we had first time perhaps in Jewish history, normally Jews in the past were always happy that it should not say in your birth certification Jewish in Russia and other places, and after 1989 you could go to Germany and you get all the benefits. So people put Jewish in the birth certification, and for us rabbis it's a very, very difficult situation, and everybody has to be checked out that he's really Jewish if he wants to have a circumcision or if he wants to get married. So we checked him out, he was Jewish, and we went to Antwerp, hour and a half. He's sitting in the back of my car, very, very nervous. We come to the place where we do the circumcision, and when he sees the Moel, that's the person on the right, who's also the butcher in Antwerp, so it made him even more nervous. He looks like a golem, like very strong, but he has like hands from gold. And we went to his house, and in his house, in the first floor, they have a place where he's a professional for adult circumcision. Not every Moel can do it. So he goes up with Moldavansky. I'm with my friend, you see there on the right, and I tell to my friend, he's so nervous, let's sit down and say some Tehillim that Hashem should bless him, it shouldn't be pain, it should go schnell, it should go quick and without any problems. After 10 minutes, the Moel is coming down the stairs alone, white in his face, and he's crying. So I go like, oy vey, now he killed him. Why did I bring him here? It's a whole catastrophe. So I asked him, what happened? He said, not now, I need a second mole. So I was like, okay, it's bleeding, he cannot stop the bleeding. And we start to heal him, and well, second mole comes, runs up the stairs. 10 minutes later, second mole comes down crying also. First mole comes down crying. We started nearly to cry. But then Moldavansky, Leonid, came down and he was smiling like a baby. So what's going on here? So the Moalim said, first sit down, some vodka, we have to say L'chaim right away. So what's the story? The story is like this. He said, I was ready to do the circumcision with Leonid, and then I'm seeing, saying, what's going on? I cannot do your circumcision. Why not? You're circumcised already. I said, no, I'm not circumcised. He said, sorry. He is so far away from his Judaism, he doesn't even know what a Jewish circumcision really is. I don't know where and what to cut, he thought, but he said, no, I was not circumcised. So the Moel tells him, I see this is a Jewish circumcision, and this is not a circumcision. Sometimes children, I don't know, it's in English, fimose, if it's the foreskin is too tight, a doctor has to cut it. Sometimes it happens to babies. I see this was done by a Moel, by a Jewish professional, it was not done by a doctor. He said, impossible. So they started to fight. He said, impossible, but I'm seeing it. So he called a second Moel to give his opinion. A second Moel also said, this was done by a Jewish professional. He said, impossible. Why you think it's impossible? He said, I tell you why. Because in Dniepropetrovsk in Ukraine, my father was one of the leading communists in the city. In my family, they hated Judaism with a passion. Even on Pesach, we ate bread. We didn't have Yom Kippur. We had no Chanukah. We had no nothing. We didn't tell nobody we were Jewish, and it was, you know, the word Jew was like a curse word in our family. Impossible that my father, the head of the Communist Party in the city, that he organized a secret circumcision. But it seemed, and this made everybody cry, that his holy communist father organized such a secret circumcision that it took the child 55 years to find out that he's circumcised. Veterans Day, a very important day for all the Russian Jews. The day in May when the Russian the Red Army, the victory over Nazi Germany, so for sure a big party in our community. And all the Russian Jews come with all the medals. And then I'm meeting the oldest Jew of the community, even though he doesn't look that old, but he's over 90 years old. And I ask him, you ever put tefillin in your life? He said, never. So I said, that's the day, let's put tefillin. So we put tefillin and we asked somebody to make the picture. And then he told me, when the guy was getting ready with the camera, he told me, you know, Rabbi, today is the real victory. Much more victory you can't really have. You know, I'm Jewish, I'm a communist, I'm in Germany, in a synagogue, with tefillin. How much more victory over the Nazis you really want? Krefeld also got a mikveh, which we finished 2 years ago, thanks to a lot of donations and help of the Merkas Rabbanei Europa, the center of European rabbis, who helped us with donations. So We come to the last part. And the last part, you see anti-Semitism today. Baruch Hashem, this picture is not coming out of Krefeld. And it's not coming out even from Germany. This picture is coming out from France. And if you ask me, in the moment now in Europe, that's France, worse. Sweden, very problematic. Belgium, getting more and more problematic. Not Germany, and this picture is out of France. Germany also always had the neo-Nazi parties. But Germany is, the only country in the world where it's a crime to deny the Holocaust. If you deny the Holocaust, you go to prison. And just half a year ago, there was a woman, 90 years old, who claimed two times before a reporter that Auschwitz was not a destruction camp, a death camp, it was a working labor camp, and that's all. She claimed it, somebody took her to court, and she's 90 years old, and she went to prison for this. If you go like this in Germany, Heil Hitler, you go to prison for this. And I remember as a bocher, before I was married, two Bachurim from Chabad came from America on Merkelschlichus to Germany, and we are walking on the streets of Wuppertal, not that far from Krefeld, with our hats. Next to the Jewish community is a park, and on the park bench, two neo-Nazis like this, and for them it's a big simcha, first time in their life they see like really Jews, you know, you have to say something when you as a Nazi, that's a big thing. So they went like Heil Hitler. Hashem made it this way that exactly in this second, when he was screaming Heil Hitler, two police came around the corner. When they heard, they scream at us, Heil Hitler, it took like 20 seconds, they were handcuffed like this, with the blue light on top, and they were taken away. Normally, the Nazis hate everybody who's different from somebody they call Arya. Arya, it's in English also, Irish. Aryan, like Hitler, you know, like two meters and blonde and strong. So the Nazis hate everybody who's different from themselves, and normally they hate the Muslims as well very much. But when, you remember 3 years ago, I think, when Israel, the Israeli army went into Gaza, then suddenly we see a march of the Nazis together with the Palestinians against the United States and against the State of Israel. And when we look into the history of the Nazis, we see that strong radical Muslims very much liked to work together with the Nazis against the Jewish people. If you speak about anti-Semitism in Germany today, there's a difference if you have a speaker coming like me from West Germany or you have a speaker from East Germany. The wall is not there anymore, but there's still a wall in the head of many people, and there's still a big difference between the West and the East. My colleague, Rabbi Segal from Chabad in Berlin, one morning he came to open up the Jewish kindergarten, and that's the way he found it, you know, all the swastikas. And you see, the Nazis are so stupid, they don't even know how to make a swastika the right way. When Israel went to Gaza, it made a wave of anti-Semitism all over Europe, especially over Germany. And I'm walking from my house to the synagogue for many, many years. And never ever, like let's say in 15 years, 20 years, three times, four times, somebody told me something bad. Normally what happens, in the last time it happened much more, that people are coming to me and say, we are very happy that you walk with a hat and with a kippah. And Germans are coming and say, we are very happy you're not afraid of what's going on with terrorism, and yet you walk proud. So nothing really happened ever to me. But when Israel went to Gaza, from one day to the other, the whole climate changed. And I could feel anti-Semitism on the street coming from the Muslim community. People were spitting at us, people were screaming at us, people were throwing things at us, and it became so bad that the community had to pay a bodyguard for 5 weeks to take me and my family home on Shabbat, because we cannot drive and we cannot take a cell phone from the community to my house, because I have to walk half an hour through the city center. And after 5 weeks, the whole thing stopped. During this time, the Arabs made a mass demonstration in Berlin against Israel, and suddenly something happened when nobody ever believed that this is possible again in Germany. Suddenly, you can see it on YouTube, the Arabs started to scream in one voice on the streets of Berlin, Jews, Jews into the gas, Jews, Jews into the gas. And it was a big scandal. So much so that on the next day, the biggest German newspaper called Bild Zeitung made a title page and says, "Never again hate against the Jews. We have to learn what happened on the 9th November 1938, and we have to raise our voice. If the flame is small, we can put it out. But if we look away what's going on, then it can become a big fire." And within 24 hours, they had like statements from everybody, like famous from Angela Merkel to big politicians to actors. Everybody was there on the front page with a statement. What happened in Berlin, not in my name, and I tried to raise my voice. A month or two months later, the Council of German Jewry, together with the Bundestag, the parliament, asked for a mass demonstration solidarity with the Jewish community in Germany and with the State of Israel. And then you had about, I don't know, like 50, 60,000 people came to Berlin for a mass demonstration. Merkel was there, the foreign minister was there, the whole Bundestag, the whole parliament, everybody was there. Ronald Laude from the World Jewish Congress gave a speech against anti-Semitism. And our community went all the 5 hours to Berlin. And it was very heartwarming to see how many people said what happened here on this street. Something like this, we cannot tolerate it, and we have to make we have to raise our voice. So our president, there were many posters, and our president took one poster from the from this march. He took back to our community, and he placed this poster. You remember the six stones from the memorial where the old synagogue stood? He placed it over there, and after a week, the sign is gone. So he's calling his friend from the police. You say, and he asked him, you know where our sign is? We placed it over there. The police said we took it away. Why you took it away? Because somebody did something to it. So here it says in German, "Stand up, never again hate against the Jews." And somebody came and with a knife or a key or whatever, he took out one word, and now it says, "Stand up, never again Jews." So everything I tell you sounds very nice. Germany changed, etc., etc. But chas v'shalom, I'm not telling you that there's no anti-Semitism. I don't tell you that the people laugh today, the Jews. Anti-Semitism is like dust. Sometimes you don't see it. You blow a little bit, and then it comes out. When a court in Cologne, three and a half years ago, tried to make circumcision illegal in Germany, finally we could see the real anti-Semitism in Germany, because all the anti-Semites had the first time since the Holocaust the possibility to hide themselves against an argument. We are not against the Jews, we just care about the Jewish babies. How you can make a circumcision to an 8-year-old baby? He has to be 18 years old, he has to decide for himself. But you could see that this is real anti-Semitism. And Rabbi Lau, chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, former chief rabbi of Israel, he said in a German newspaper, "I just wish that the people would have such a pity on our children a couple of years earlier." So there you can really see that there is anti-Semitism like all over. There is anti-Semitism where people don't know that they're anti-Semitic. I once gave a lecture to non-Jewish people about kosher, and then I explained you have to have a mashgiach and this and that and the restaurant. So somebody said, then kosher food must be much more expensive than non-kosher food. And a woman stood up and she said, "Yeah, but the Jews are all rich." I mean, amen, yeah, but this is coming from anti-Semitism. All the Jews are rich, and so she didn't know that it's something anti-Semitic, and it sometimes it's very deep by the people that they don't understand that this is coming from not such a kosher source. Normally the lecture would be finished, if not 2015. We had the refugee crisis, and in 2015, Germany let in between 1,100,000 to 1,200,000 refugees, mainly from Syria, into the country without any passport control. And the Jewish community in 2015 was screaming, "Stop it, you have to close. Perhaps you don't have to close the border, but you have to have a system that you know who is coming into your country. It's normal if you go to an account." I came just this morning, I came to Los Angeles. I had to give my fingerprints, I had to give my passport. It's just, you know, it's like, believe, just imagine a million people are flying today to Los Angeles, and everybody just goes into the cabs, into the buses, and then is disappearing somewhere in the country. The Jewish community was screaming, but nobody was listening to us, and that's the way. It happened. Here you have a picture from the train station in Munich. Every day 10,000 people went into the city and then just disappeared somewhere in the country. The first weeks in Germany there was such a high The people were standing by the train stations, welcome asylum seekers and refugees. Everybody was positive. People were collecting toys for the children. Nobody was allowed to say one negative word of what's going on. But then we saw suddenly all the Nazis, nearly forgotten, somehow they woke up and they started to march against the refugees, and they started to make the people aware what's going on in Germany, and more people followed, and the right-wing people became much more stronger through the refugees coming to Germany. And then terrorism started also in Germany. We had people there, pictures of people made from refugees themselves. They went to the police and said, I am living in an asylum seeker flat house, and the guy who's living next door, I know that he cut off heads in Syria. And he had pictures of such people, and they went to the police themselves. I spoke to the refugees. And they told me, we reported the other refugees from ISIS to the police, and suddenly the people in Germany and the police and the politicians started a little bit to wake up to see what really happened. They caught people, they had four different passports. You didn't know who all these people were. 2013, he's fighting for ISIS in Syria. In 2015, he's coming as a normal-looking refugee. And yeah, that's the problem. Chas v'shalom, I'm not saying that 1,000,000, 2,000 people who came to Germany are terrorists. God forbid. Germany needs to be the country number one in the world to understand if people are running away from terror, who needs to help? It needs to be Germany to understand from the war, we have to be the first to help. But there would have been a better system of how to help the people. 1,100,000, if just 5% or 2% are people who are like sleepers, they're called in Germany, who are ready to commit crimes, 1,100,000, 2% is a lot of dangerous people in the country. So security went up like crazy. And here you see a picture of the Jewish quarter in Antwerp. The police stopped patrolling over there alone. They're doing it together with the military. So you have tanks, it's like crazy, standing there in the Jewish quarter, and you have them walking with the machine guns when the children have finished school or kindergarten. They're on all the corners, because it's not a question of if something will happen, it's a question when, chas v'shalom, something can happen. Same in Germany. If you ever plan a visit to Germany, just to walk into a Jewish community on Shabbat can be a challenge, because somebody will ask you for a passport, and it's a little bit like going through the airport, and that's the way sometimes Jewish community looks, that you have the police guarding them. And also by us, the police is always before the door, and security in Krefeld is also a very big topic. And then it happened on 24 July 2016. We had the first suicide bombing ever. Suicide bombing, I mean, it's something we knew from Israel, but not from Germany. And then a refugee blew himself up in Ansbach. And then this year, 19th December 2017, with this big trolley truck, he drove through a Christmas market, killing many, many people, and the terrorism became a big problem. 16? 2016, it's a mistake, okay. The alternative for Germany... Chas v'shalom. The alternative for Germany is a new party. It's a right-wing party. And after all this terrorism which happened, they became so strong that everybody became very, very afraid of this party. And we just had now elections. And here you see the normal parties which are always elected in Germany. You have the Christian Democratic Union, you have the left, you have the Social Party Germany, SPD, you have the Greens, you have the Free Democrat Party, and then you have the Nazi Party in blue. And you see, this is from East Germany. It became first round, more or less, it became the third strongest party, and then you see that all the other parties, they all went down, and they were the only ones to go up with a little bit of the FDP. Why? Because the other parties didn't understood the fear of the people from the immigrants. So the Nazis, they spoke like a very clear language. Vote for us, you know, we kick them all out, and all this Nazi propaganda. And many people who were disappointed by the normal parties, they voted for the AfD, and now they're sitting for the first time. This is from the, this is from the parliament, the big parliament in Berlin. You know, they became the third biggest party to sit first time. People who are not that far away from Nazi ideology are sitting in a parliament in Germany, and this is just a couple of weeks ago that we had the election. So you had this picture, 1939-2016. There's always hope, and there's always the victory, and this we see on Hanukkah. I want to end you with one last story, an amazing story which happened to me. There's a company in Frankfurt, near Frankfurt, and this company is producing coatings for pills, and they need kosher. This company is calling me up to visit the company. I'm driving 3 hours to Frankfurt. I'm coming to the parking lot, and I see somebody in a very expensive suit is looking for me, waiting for me, very, very nervous. I'm parking, he's coming to my car, and from 5 meters I see already the guy must be Jewish. He looks very, very Jewish, but I didn't tell him nothing. We are on the way to his office. I didn't tell him shalom. I just tried to speak how was my drive, how was the weather, and I get this feeling the guy is nuts. He looks at me like a ghost. He doesn't answer my questions. You know, he's just walking, and we go to his office. We're sitting in his office, and in the middle of one of my sentences, the guy stands up, and he goes to the door and he locks the door. So I go like, uh-oh. Then he went to the window and he closed the window sheets. And then he went to his desk and he opened it. So I was like, Hashamnu, Bagadnu, Shema Yisrael. Baruch Hashem, he did not take out a gun. He took out a computer, a notebook. He opened the notebook and he showed me a picture. On this picture, I see this guy with his daughter in Manhattan, in New York, holding the Arba Minim on Sukkot. So I tell him, like if I didn't saw before, oh, you're Jewish? And he tells me, yes, but nobody knows about it. I was like, if you ever looked into a mirror or something, but he told me nobody knows about it, and I don't want anybody to know about it. And since I have now first time the opportunity to speak to a rabbi, I want to talk to you. I have the feeling that God is playing games with me. So why you think God is playing games with you? Because every place I'm going, the people ask me if I'm Jewish. He said, I was in Jordan. I had to make a contract for the company. The sheikh came in and he screamed, I don't sign, Israeli is Jewish. So he said, no, I'm not Jewish, I'm Catholic. And then he told me, I'm so far away from my Judaism that I married on purpose a German woman. I even took her last name as my last name, so you shouldn't see from the last name somehow it's a typical Jewish last name. That's how far away I am. And he said, and then it happened, I had to go to Israel for the business, that's why we need now the kosher. I was in Tel Aviv, I was in a pizza place. I came out of the toilet and suddenly somebody grabbed me and told me, ah, great, you're number 10. So he said, how he knew I'm Jewish? You know, I said, they put something on my head. I said, you just have to say amen, it's fine. So Hashem said, God is playing games with me. So I told him, listen, be very happy that God really wants you in his team. And God is behind you. And that's also not so good. So embrace your Judaism. Learn about your Judaism. Have you ever been to the big, beautiful synagogue in Frankfurt, still from before the war, the Nazis didn't destroy it? He said, never. So I said, let's make the kashrut over here. And then we go and we visit, first time in your life, we go to the synagogue in Frankfurt. Chabad has a yeshiva over there. And one bocher was learning. And we came, and for sure, Chabad, we put tefillin on him. He put tefillin and he cried like a baby. So Chabad rabbis, we know, people put tefillin first time, they cry like a baby. 20 minutes later, everything forgotten and back to normal. So I gave him the telephone number of the rabbi, Rabbi Havlin, and I told him, you know, if you ever have time, give him a call. Perhaps you can learn something about Judaism. And that's how we parted. I'm forgetting about the whole thing. A year later, I have to make a second visit to this company, and I'm curious. I remember the story, and I asked the guy, doctor, did you ever, he's a doctor, did you ever went back to the synagogue in Frankfurt? And he tells me, this was like before the high holidays, he tells me, oy vey, so I understood he went. Oy vey, every morning slichot, so early. So I tell him, wow, you go to slichot, the morning prayer. He said, yes, sure, so you know the rabbi. I said, yeah, he didn't say Rabbi Havel, he said, Yossi, my good friend, we learn twice a week, we learn. I said, wow, that's amazing what happened in this year. He said, and Rabbi, I want to tell you the nicest things which happened to me. I had to go for business again to New York, and I went with my German wife, and Rabbi Yossi told me, when I'm going to New York, next to the JFK airport is the gravesite of the Holy Lubavitcher Rebbe. I should go and make a prayer over there. So that's the oil. So that's what I did. I went to the oil, and if you ever have been there, there's like a tent, you sit down, you write your note, and then he told to his German wife, you better stay over here. This is something Jewish, I want to do this alone. And he was on the way to the door to go outside to go to the oil. Somebody with a hat and with a beard, and I really believe it could have been Eliyahu Navi, stopped him. And he told him, what's with your wife? Why you don't take her? So he said, because she's not Jewish. And he said, Jewish, not Jewish. I think you should take her also to the oil. Both went to the oil. They stayed for 30 minutes in the oil. They come out, back to the tent. She looks at him, and she tells him these words. In the last year, I saw how beautiful our family became through keeping Shabbos, how much meaning even eating got in our our house, how nice it is, and how much the family is getting together through all this Judaism. And I want to sit and I want to learn. I want to learn the letters, the alphabet, and I want to be Jewish. I want to convert, and I want to do it the kosher way as well. When the doctor told it to me, he was crying. He said, I was never thinking about pushing my wife to do a conversion and now to get the whole Jewish family. And he was very, very excited. That's how we parted. Next year, I have to make another visit. You see, every year something interesting is happening. And he tells me, Rabbi, good news, we are moving to Washington, D.C. We are building a second company over there because it's much cheaper to produce in America to serve the American market than to do it in Germany. And please, this is the address, and I want to buy a house over there, a suburb of Washington. Please find me the next Chabad over there so we have somebody to go to. I looked on Chabad.org, I see his address, I see what's the next Chabad, I give him the address, and then a week later he's going with his German wife to Washington. So they're looking now for this address. So you have somebody who just knows one synagogue in his life, it's like a 200 meter big building in Frankfurt, and he's looking for something similar in America. So he has problems finding it because the Chabad used to be a former FedEx or UPS or something. So after finding, he found the place, and yeah, they sit down with the rabbi, and the rabbi tells him, Judaism, here there's a place called Fairfax, I think. Judaism is much stronger over here. Here's a suburb. I would suggest you go better over there, you know, to look over there. We don't have conversion classes for your wife and whatever. He was a little bit it was not what he was supposed to, what he hoped to find in America, and they come out from this meeting, and then in this second the cell phone of his German wife rings on the other line. Her mother in Germany. They speak, and she hears that the daughter sounds somehow depressed and sad. She said, darling, what's going on? Why are you so sad? So she said, Mom, better sit down. I have to tell you something. You know, I married a Jewish husband. I want to be Jewish as well. So when the mother in Germany heard about this, she became nuts, and she started to curse her. Why you want to be a Jew? And you know, the Jews, and blah, 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 blah. You know, everything came out. And in the end, she said, it seems that this foolishness gets inherited. And she puts down the phone. So the doctor tells her, what do you mean it gets inherited? Call her back. So she calls back, Mama, what do you mean it gets inherited? She said, darling, now you sit down. I tell you something. You're not Jewish. You're a Catholic. And I'm a Catholic, a very proud Catholic. My mother was born Jewish, but that's finished. So the doctor, he hears, one second, there's something about the mother is Jewish, the children are Jewish. So he calls me up in the middle of the night, Washington time, in the middle of my German time. He says, Rabbi, I'm sorry to wake you up, but I'm very, very nervous. If the mother of my wife is Jewish, this means my wife is Jewish as well. So I tell him, yeah, if she converted to Christianity, it's cut. said, you can never cut it, you can never change it. When he was like, oh, I married a German Schicksal on purpose, and in the end, you know, I found out that she's Jewish. 2 years. 2 years ago, the highlight, it's coming up soon, the banquet in New York, where all the Chabad rabbis are getting together. And in the end, there's a dance with all the supporters. And I'm like 5,000 people dancing. And I'm dancing and I'm looking who's holding my right hand. From 5,000 people, it's this guy from the story. So he became a big supporter of the Chabad, which used to be a FedEx. He became still a Chabad supporter of Frankfurt. He's helping out in Krefeld. And it's just an amazing story. So if you like it or not, the Jews are back in Germany, and this is my story. Thank you very much.
Firstly, I want to say a very special thank you to Rabbi Wagner for this astounding news and account.
I have to add a sentence also.
I'm going to have you add a sentence. I also want to make mention of the fact that tonight's evening is, first and foremost, an event of the Menachem Institute, our adult education institute. And as we mentioned before, at the outset, we try our very best to come up with different and new angles and new ideas and new topics. So if you enjoyed tonight, please spread the word to friends that when we make an event, you should please come and join us, because this is the caliber of what we're putting on here at the Menachem Institute at Chabad of the Valley. I also want to mention that this is also an event that's put together by the Turk Family Sacred Memorial in memory of Israel and Luli Turk. And we should understand that this is a family that suffered greatly in the Churban, in the Holocaust, and have dedicated a very, very beautiful memorial and foundation to keeping Judaism alive in memory of all of their family that perished in the Holocaust. Rabbi Wagner, first of all, before we go, how about a big round of applause for Rabbi Wagner? I'm going to ask him a question, but first I'm going to let him go, because he said he had one more sentence he wanted to add, and then I have a question, and then we'll ask him if he can take a couple of questions too, and then I know he has to put his kids back to bed. But
I can't let you go without telling you that many things you saw in the lecture in the last years are mamish connected and standing on the shoulders of Rabbi Gordon. When I came 3 years ago to Los Angeles, about this time, 4 years ago by now, to Los Angeles this time, it was a tough time for us in the community, political problems a little bit. And we had a meeting with him. I just knew him from email and from the Daily Tanya. And we were sitting with him in his office in Encino. And the way he talked to us gave such an inspiration that we came back to Germany with such a power that we started to start the Mikveh project, which is built because of this. We started to make Miftzoim every Friday again. We visit hundreds of families. The minyan doubled, and this is all standing on him. Every morning, I'm taking my children to the kindergarten in Düsseldorf with Rabbi Gordon. I take them back from the kindergarten with Rabbi Gordon with the daily Tanya. I take him then with the daily Chumash, and I'm feeling very, 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 so much connected. And we just came today to Los Angeles. We just came out of the airplane with two little children, and I feel like I feel a little bit like drunk, you know, with all this 16 hours flying and the time difference and the jet lag. But it was for me very important to speak in such a place to let you know that when you have no idea, when you support Chabad of the Valley, you're not just supporting Chabad of the Valley, you support also Chabad all over, and not just Chabad, you support Am Yisrael all over, because the work you do here in this holy valley, it's like Kimitzion Tetzet Torah, it's also from the valley, is coming the Torah all over, especially to Germany, and me, my family, and our community is very thankful for what you did for us without even knowing that you did it. Thank you very much.